This is Metal Mike, and in this episode, I bring you hair metal, controversy, and conspiracy. Me and my associate Ryan bring you ghost musicians, shady business deals, impersonators, and high-level song thievery. Now, are you a fan of this podcast? Then keep the truth alive and consider being a supporter through Anchor. There's a link in the description below. Now proceed with caution if you dare and check it out.
Well, Ryan, welcome to the 80s Glam Metalcast, man. How you doing?
I'm great, man. Thanks for having me back again.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, man, I'm super psyched about this one. You know, I'm a big conspiracy theory guy, you know, and not that I always believe the conspiracies, but I always find, like, alternative points of view kind of interesting, you know? And I'm huge into hair metal, and I started to think, is there any way to combine these two worlds? So that's what we're going to try to accomplish tonight.
All right. Well, it can work, I think.
I think so. I'm going to just throw out a quick disclaimer. So, you know, the title of this video is probably very clickbaitish, right? We've got you in. We've got you to watch this thing. None of these theories are our own. This is all just stuff that is out there that you've heard about, message boards, blabbermouth. It's all out there. And it's a lot of it's stuff that the bands themselves have claimed or people associated with the bands. Maybe you've heard this stuff before. Maybe you haven't. This might just be a nice place where we can just kind of compile a lot of it. I know it fascinates me. I think you kind of got fascinated by all of it. And you can't do it all. You know what I mean? So, like, somebody's going to come in and say, oh, you didn't talk about this. Yeah, there's no way. There's too much. You can't cover it all. And lastly, I'm not touching Kiss. Kiss needs to be a full episode on its own because there's way too much about Kiss. Okay.
So that's... You know, I was going to say the same exact thing about Dawkins.
Some of these bands, man, yeah, there's a lot. Motley Crue's another one. Like, I know we'll scratch the surface with Crue, but once again, just read the dirt, man. It's all pretty much all there.
Oh, yeah. And all I could say in regards to all that is I remember back in the day before social media, you know where I got all this information? Metal Sludge. That thing delivered every day. There was some kind of new crazy rumor or crazy old stories. But, you know, it goes right along with the whole, like, you should never meet your heroes thing, mm-hmm. almost. Cause to be honest, sometimes I'm like, man, I wish I was just a fan and not an aficionado. Yeah. Not both, you know what I mean? Yep. And at this point, it's like, I think we talked before about how after reading the Piercy book and this and that, you go, God, they weren't even friends after Invasion. Mm-hmm. And here we are rocking them. I wish I could just kind of have that innocence and rock with Reach for the Sky at Detonator and be okay with it, not knowing all the dirt behind it. But, you know, that's why we're such dedicated fans, and this is what we're doing this today.
All right. Well, you know what, man? Without hesitation, I'm going to jump in with my first tale here. It's Warrant, man. You know, I mean, the rumor. It's not even really a rumor anymore. You know what I mean? Pretty much the guys in Warrant have agreed that this happened. Bo Hill has talked about it. Mike Slammer has talked about it. That Mike Slammer played either all the solos and probably just the majority of the guitar on Dirty Rotten Filthy Stinkin' Rich and on Cherry Pie. And, I mean, that's pretty much out there. You know, you could look it up and yourself and check it out. You know, it kind of sounds like maybe the guys weren't really, or Bo wasn't really hearing it with what they were doing, and he brought in Slammer. Mm-hmm. Now, the crazy thing is, let me just read something that Slammer said. So he said, that was a long time ago, and I don't remember all the bands, but I did a lot of guitar work on the first two Warren albums. During those days, I did lots of session work for Bo, and some of it was as a ghost player, you know, don't tell anyone. So that got me thinking, man. I'm like, okay, dude. All right, so we know the Mike Slammer thing with Warrant. What else did this guy play on? So then what I started doing, it, I'm like a glam metal private investigator, right? So I start looking up every album that Bo Hill produced, okay? And I found mm-hmm. something weird, man. So maybe this is one of my own little discoveries that I didn't find, you know, on Blabbermouth or whatever else. Midnight Dynamite by Kix. And it says Mike Slammer additional guitars, and it sounds like he played on Walking Away and Scarlet Fever. So I'm not super familiar with that album. So this is just a few that you know about. What ones do we not know about that he played on? You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And I love Kix, and I never knew that. I have all their stuff, and that was actually my choice album for a long time by them. Oh yeah, I'm surprised I never sat there and nerded out on the liner notes and discovered that myself.
Yeah. And I think a lot of things, man, as I go back and I try to think back of interviews that I've done with people, some things that they've said kind of reveal some of these things too. Like when I interviewed Joey Allen, I mean, they were promoting like the Cherry Pie Tour. I wasn't going to be like a dick and say, hey, man, is it true you didn't play on those? I just can't do that. You know what I mean? It's just not cool.
No.
It's already been done. It's already been said. But, you know, when I asked him what was his favorite album out of those first three, he did say Dog Eat Dog. And once again, he might just like Dog Eat Dog, but does he like Dog Eat Dog because he really didn't have much, you know, input on those first two? I don't know. Something to think about.
Well, he had 5 or 6 years to practice guitar, so he probably nailed those guitar albums.
So while I'm on the topic of Bo Hill, one thing that he said was that we didn't talk about Mike Slammer at all, but he did talk about Reb Beach and Kip Winger, and he said that those were his go-to guys on projects that he did. So once again, makes you wonder, what albums are Kip and Reb on that we don't know about? Now, one that is pretty much also, this is not a secret, it's pretty much established in interviews with Bo Hill and stuff, is that Reb Beach played majority of the guitar on Twisted Sister's Love Is for Suckers.
Exactly, which was supposed to be a D solo album, right?
Yeah, supposed to be a D solo album, and you know, maybe those, it was just going to be session guys, you know what I mean, to play on it or whatever, because those guys weren't big at that point. You know, yeah, Bo said 90% of it was done by him. When I talked to JJ French, he couldn't remember. He knew he played on some of it. So here's what I did. I went back the other day and I listened to the songs. And if you like that album, go back and listen to the solos. I think you can. I don't think Reb Beach did all of them. I'm gonna be honest. I don't think he did 90% of them the way it said, because there's certain songs like Hot Love and Love Is for Suckers. I know that's him. It's not because it's like shredding or going. It's just kind of slick sounding. You know, it sounds like him. And then there's other songs. I want to say the song Tonight and even Wake Up the Sleeping Giant. You listen to those solos, and they sound more old school, like kind of like Ace Frehley type of stuff. And if you go back and listen to some of the previous Twisted Sister albums, that's kind of how J.J. French plays, you know. And I know Eddie Ojeda, I'm not sure. I don't sit and analyze guitar solos, but I could tell, like, a couple of them sounded more old school, and then other ones sounded more slick. So I think when you catch those slicker ones, that's Reb Beach, you know what I mean? But I think those guys were involved, just, you know, like the Twisted Sister guys were involved with that album, but probably not as much as we think they were. You know what I mean? So that's another one that people may or may not know.
Yeah. Well, listening to Mike Slammer play guitars on his band Steelhouse Lane, and he's got a band called Streets back in the day.
Yep.
Dude, those two albums are so good. They're so perfect. And I could see how that guy was hired as a session musician on several bands recording studio sessions, because, dude, I mean, you got the guys in, like, let's just take Warrant, for example. Yeah, we love Warrant. We think they're killer, but I often think, like, man, how much time did you have to practice in the heyday when they were doing nothing but playing every night at, I mean, that's practice in itself, but, you know, doing the Sunset Strip thing, that's a lot of social practice, if you will, besides, you know, sitting there and nerding out on guitar. So I could absolutely see it going that way, and it probably worked out well. I mean, look at the solo for Mr. Rainmaker. Dude, that solo is so freaking killer. Like, I don't know. When I heard this kind of confirmed rumor about Slammer playing guitars, I went, ah, yes. Let's listen to Mr. Rainmaker. That guitar solo is tough, and it's awesome. So I could see it totally happening there.
You know what else is a cool one that stands out to me? I mean, and I'm looking at this from a standpoint that Bo Hill's trying to get some hits here, is Sometimes She Cries, man.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Like a hit ballad
absolutely
type of thing. Yeah. So I think that's what he's looking for. He's looking for some real catchy melodic stuff. And I'm sure Joey Allen was competent. It's just that, you know, at this point, Bo Hill is, you know, he's been through the mill. You know, he did Rat. He did all these other things. He's looking for some big hits. So you can't fault the guy.
Yeah. Totally.
So, man, throw me out some of the things you've been looking up. What do you got? Hit me with one.
Well, I'll hit you with another ghost musician. Let's talk about the Cinderella drumming saga.
Oh, yeah. I got this one, too.
It's not necessarily ghost musicians, because they're pretty frank about it, but would they have Cozy Powell? Is that who they have playing? In Fred Curry's place.
Yep.
Poor guy, they were featured on the album cover and in the notes, and they just said, sorry, kid, you know, maybe by the third album. And I think he did play on the third album, I think.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there he was kind of getting aced out on the first two. So that's another confusing one for fans. Fred Perry seemed pretty legit to me, but yeah. they just needed that certain sound. So there's another kind of ghost musician that I'm sure 10% of the fans out there know about.
So I looked this one up, and this is a question. I don't even know where this is, some kind of interview that somebody did with Long Cold Winter. No, they did the interview with Tom Kiefer. Okay, oh no. Did Cozy Powell play drums on Long Cold Winter? Tom. He played most of the drums. Fred was new to the band. We had a session drummer on our first record, and Fred came in and did the tour. Fred was very young. He came back in to do Long Cold Winter. Andy didn't think he was quite there. We had a couple of guys come in, and he woodshed it and worked really hard. He played on the next record, Heartbreak Station, and he did a great job. So basically, he's saying that, you know, it sounded like there was a bit of a debacle. I think some guy named, hold on, I've got this written down too. Oh, Randy Cort. So Randy Cortez. Now, there's some rumors out there. This is another one. This was actually, strangely enough, this was just on Metal Sludge the other day. Are there copies, supposedly there's copies, of Randy Cortez's picture on the back? You know, there's like little squares of the guys on the back of Night Songs. So the rumor is that there's Fred Curry's on the front, and then this Cortez guy is in one of the squares on the back of a limited run. But nobody can confirm this, so, you know, who knows if this actually true or not. Another thing
was, I gotta look at my album.
Yeah, you gotta see which one you got. Now, another thing was Cinderella, which, just look it up. They were supposed to do an album in 1999. John Klodner there, the guy that, you know, brought Aerosmith back. And he actually brought Rat, and he brought back Great White. He gave them kind of like semi-major label deals in the late 90s. And Cinderella was supposed to be part of that. And then something went wrong. Like I said, check it out. But there was like 3 years where Cinderella were like tied up. They couldn't do an album. They couldn't go on another label. But then that album never came out. So, and that's kind of why Tom started to go the solo route at first, because there was some kind of issue with Cinderella recording because of this litigation. So there's a whole other thing, man. There was supposed to be a Cinderella album in 99, and it never happened.
Damn. That would have been cool.
Yeah, it would have been, right?
Yeah. I'll hit you with one that I'm sure you're wildly aware of, and that's the two Dio guitarists exiting. So
yeah.
Talk about Vivian leaving Dio and Whitesnake, and then Craig Goldie, you know, in his interview with you, he left us as a cliffhanger with why he left Dio in the first place.
Right.
And he promised to fill you in at some point, and man, I've listened to that interview twice, actually left me on the edge of my seat, because I was dying to know what happened, because they were boys after that, and you know, he loved him. And so, the Goldie thing is one, but, you know, Vivian leaving Dio is pretty public in terms of the disdain felt between the two. In fact, there's that Dio interview from, you know, mid-2000s era when he was asked about Vivian Campbell, and he still had nothing good to say about him. So that's a real weird one. And then the whole Whitesnake exit, too, looked like they were prepping to start rehearsing for Slip of the Tongue, and Vivian came in with kind of a shitty attitude, and Coverdale just basically said, hey, bro, if you're not into this, you're out of here, and that was it for him, too, which is weird, because Vivian is such a longtime member of Def Leppard.
Right.
Those guys don't screw around, you know, and they love the fact that they're a brotherhood, and he stood into some really big shoes when Steve Clark died, and it seems to have been going great for the last 30 years. So I'm confused as to why these personalities didn't work in Dio and Whitesnake, but worked great in Def Leppard. So, you know, that's your cue, because you know the Goldie interview stuff way more than I do.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's definitely a lot of bad blood. I know, and it goes the other way, too. Campbell said a lot of bad stuff about Dio before he died, and, you know, and it kind of never really got settled. It, you know, that's too bad. Craig Goldie, though, yeah, and that, honestly, you know, I'll be honest, I've been pushing my podcast in a lot of these message boards, and I think that one came up as well. Like, what is Craig Goldie waiting for? Like, you know, at a certain point, no one's going to care. You know, too much time is going to pass, and people aren't even going to know who what Dio is, you know, if we wait too long. But it's weird.
Maybe he's writing a book.
Yeah, maybe he's writing a book. But Yeah, it's really weird. I don't know. And you know, and you mentioned that they got back together and did it okay anyway. So, yeah, like what happened? And then obviously it blew over and he came back. And there's the whole Tracy G thing. That was a whole other thing where Tracy G gets into detail of how he kind of got pushed out of the band because of the fans. The fans really didn't like him. The fans wanted to return to form, and he wasn't going to be part of that. He had the ability to stay on as like a second guitarist, and he wanted no part of it. And in turn, that was where kind of how I kind of got introduced to Craig Goldie to talk to him. He jumped right in on the comments on YouTube of my video, and he said, "Hey, you know, that's not how it went down. You know, we would have been equals. I really wanted to play with him." So, you know, once again, with all this stuff, man, you got different points of views. Certain people remember it different. What's true? What's false? You don't know.
Exactly. You got to remember, I guess this is a business, and these guys are trying to make a living, even though we're just big time fan with it. This is their livelihood, so there had to be a little bit of that mixed in there.
So let's talk about some controversy that surrounds the Pretty Boy Floyd Leather Boys with Electric Toys album. So
yeah, this one runs deep. This is some thick drama here.
This is crazy. So somebody told me that none of these guys played it. None of the guys from this is how rumors start. None of the guys that are in Pretty Boy Floyd played on that album, right? It was all session people. I'm like, bullshit. I know Steve Summers' voice. I know that's him. So when I had an interview with Howard Benson, I kind of just, you know, tiptoed around it, and I was like, hey, you know, do you remember there being any other guys involved? And he said that Vinny Chaz did not play bass on the album. Whatever it was, he just wasn't caught in it, and they brought somebody else in. They did bring somebody in to do all the background vocals, so which is not uncommon. That happens a lot. But Steve's and Christy Majors and the drummer, is it Christy Crash or whatever his name is, Terry Kane, I can't remember, never remember his name. But they said all those guys were there, and everybody played on it. So that's just this mild controversy. The biggest controversy is that original guitar player Ariel Stiles wrote all the songs. Now, I had been trying to get...
Right.
I've been trying to find him. I don't think that's ever happening. But I tried to... So I've been trying for years to get Christy Majors, and I finally got him. And he... I never came out and said, once again, maybe I need to be more ballsy in these interviews, but I never came out and said, hey, did you write all those songs? But in the conversation, he alluded to when we wrote those songs. I know that's said. Go back and listen to it. I know he said, when we wrote that, you know, we were young guys, and now here we are still playing it. We're older. So the vibe that I was getting is that he wrote those songs. And in turn, he's told me that he's written everything that's after it. Like the Public Enemies album, he wrote the whole album. And there's a new Pretty Boy Floyd album that he wrote the whole album. It just hasn't been released yet. So to me, he is the primary songwriter. Now, you go back and you can find interviews with Ariel Stiles. And I did find some, and I read over them. Just search Ariel Stiles, Pretty Boy Floyd. You'll find them. They're all out on the internet. And he basically said that they stole pretty much all his songs, and he received no credit for them. And remember I asked you, I go, hey, I don't have my original Pretty Boy Floyd album anymore. Do you see songwriting credits? And you could not find any songwriting credits on there, right?
No. I have the original record, the vinyl record, and I went searching for it, and I found it, and I looked for you. And actually, there is just a plastic sleeve for the record, and they don't have the regular, you know, paper liner notes with the lyrics behind it and everything. And on the back, there's, you know, a million thank yous and credits, and there's no mention of them at all.
Right. So then I went back to an interview that I did with Mike Hannon of Salty Dog. Now, he played in the band Dom. Now, the band Dahl, if you go back and you look, it's Kerry Dahl is the singer. And if you look at the Dahl album, there is a song on there called Leather Boys with Electric Toys, which is the same exact song that is on the Leather Boys with Electric Toys by Pretty Boy Floyd. And now Mike Hannon, when you listen to that interview, he says, I was playing a lot of those songs when I was in Dahl, those great songs that Ariel Stiles wrote. So seems
that,
like
there, what year was that thing? Was that well before Pretty Boy Floyd came out?
That was before Pretty Boy Floyd came out, yep. So You're getting Ariel Styles saying one thing. You're getting Christy Major saying one thing. You're getting Mike Hannon kind of backing Ariel Styles and saying, we were playing 48 hours and all that stuff before Pretty Boy Floyd even existed. Then you don't see songwriting credits on the album. So, once again, not saying there's a conspiracy theory there or whatever, but there's some weird coincidences there.
Yeah, that is weird. Which member, was it him that when you interviewed him, you said, oh, welcome to the 80s Glam Metal Cast. You know, this is seemed like the perfect place for you to be, you know? And he was like, I guess. Was that the one?
I don't know. He was super well-natured. You know? He had me laughing, and he was having a good time. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, he was super cool. Yeah, you know, I mean, he might have started off like that, but I don't really remember. A lot of them.
Yeah, well, a lot of drama surrounding that one, man. And they had Bill O'Coin was their manager, wasn't it, at the time?
He was their manager, like in the 90s when it was kind of all falling apart. And what's weird, okay. So here's what's weird. So if Ariel Styles got burnt so bad, let's play the other side. Why did he come back to the band in around 91, 92? You know, weird.
Well, maybe he wanted to reclaim his, maybe that was part of it. He needed to reclaim his stuff to make some money off of it.
So, I don't know if there's a lot of money involved with the sales of Pretty Boy Floyd. I don't know who owns that stuff. You definitely see mm-hmm. Steve Summers peddling a lot of reprints of this stuff. So, who owns the rights? I don't know. So, you know, is there money that he got screwed out of? Maybe. Ariel Styles, I don't know.
Well, speaking of stolen songs and a lot of money to be made, the saga and the tales of Joel Ellis and his claim that I'll Be There For You, the mega hit by Bon Jovi off of New Jersey, was actually written by him and his band called Merry Hoax.
Yeah.
And I read about it recently, and I heard about this years ago. He'd come after him pretty hard, I think. Mm-hmm. But the story goes, his band was recording, and obviously they were just doing rough demos, and they had a cassette tape, and the cassette had I'll Be There For You on it. And so Joel and his bandmates went down to the Rainbow, and they liked to test their material out by asking the guys there to play it over the sound system to see how the crowd reacts. And which, funnily enough, that was Bon Jovi's, I think they called it the pizza parlor test, to take their new songs to the local pizza parlor back in the day and play it and watch the kids and see what songs they react to. So this is probably pretty convenient for Ellis to be telling that story. But he took it down there, and there sat, you know, a few rock stars, Sam Kinison and these guys, and they're playing it, and it was a connection between the Bon Jovi guys, someone who managed them, I believe, and the group. And they said, oh, man, that's a great song. Let me take this cassette back to my boys in the Bon Jovi camp and see what we could do for you guys. Well, next thing you know, the cassette disappears. Joel Ellis never hears from this guy again. And Bon Jovi releases the huge hit, I'll Be There For You. Now, I would tend to believe a story like this if it wasn't coming from Joel. And after listening to, like, your interview and reading some of his stuff that he's doing these days, yes, I love Captain Boots. Yes, I love Heavy Bones. Joel Ellis has a fantastic voice. But the dude is out there, I think. You know,
yeah.
I just, there's something going on with that guy. And so it's hard for me to believe this one. I can see this happening because there are other kind of semi-documented stuff, like Ted Poley was in the band Prophet, and he claims that John Bon Jovi stole Wanted Dead or Alive from a Prophet song off the first album called Slow Down.
Hmm.
And it's similar. The guitar part is very similar to the acoustic intro to Dead or Alive. Within that song, it's called Slow Down. It's a good song, but you know, there's a lot of songs out there that are similar to one another. So this one is different in terms of what Joel said, because he says he just straight up took the song from him, never to be found again. But I don't know. I guess it'll be settled in court.
Yeah, and the thing with Joel, like you said, he's Yeah, I mean, he doesn't have a lot of great things to say about some people in the past. I don't know if he remembers it the right way. But there was one part of the story that I read, and once again, I think this is him talking about it, but he said he knew somebody, he had a girlfriend or knew some girl that was associated with the Bon Jovi camp, and they would just sit they would sit by a piano, and they would listen to all these demos, and then they would just take little parts that they liked, and then they would make them their own. I don't know, man. I can't imagine that they had trouble writing songs. If anybody, they would get Desmond Child to help them write a song. So part of me just seems like this is complete bullshit. But then again, with Ted Poley, like I said, Ted Poley is more of a credible source than Joel. But who knows, man? You know, there could be, once again, with all these stories that we're going to go over, there could be a shred of truth somewhere in there. You know what I mean? Where do these stories come from? They have to come from something. I mean, or unless they're total bullshit. I don't know. But, you know, why that song?
Absolutely.
Why that song? Why would he say that song they stole from him? You know, I don't know.
Exactly.
On the subject of Bon Jovi, this is all pretty much widely known, is that after 7800 Fahrenheit, Alec Von Such didn't play on bass on any Bon Jovi albums. I mean, this is the stories that are out there. Just search it. Search interviews with Hugh McDonald. He said he played the majority of the bass on every album after 7800 Fahrenheit. What's up with that? You know what I mean? And I don't want to shit on the guy because he's passed away, Alec Von Such, but what's up with that? You know what I mean? Why? Why was he still in the band if he wasn't cutting it on the bass? I don't know.
Agreed. Yeah, I had read about that years ago, and I know he was kind of like their hired gun, little secret weapon. But I assumed he was just like a helpful studio guy that coached Alec along the way or something, not to this extent. But I mean, I can see it. Like, you remember in the days behind the music with Bon Jovi back in the day, and they asked him about Alec John Such, and this is like, man, it was probably in like the year 2000 2001, and even at that point he goes, you know, they go, oh yeah, have you talked to him lately? He goes, you know what, I haven't talked to him, but I think about him a lot. And that was the extent of it. Like, oh, you think about him a lot? Huh. You're playing in this guy with in the band with this guy for 20 years, and you guys were extremely successful, and you haven't talked to him, but you think about him a lot? Huh. Now, there's probably something else going on there. There's some kind of controversy, or maybe they realized, we don't need you. You can't play bass anyway.
Who knows? It's,
but, you know, there's got to I definitely see the truth in that one.
Yeah. You talked about stealing songs. Poison has actually gotten sued and lost in a few instances. So, you know, somebody, once again, you know, this is the beauty of the internet, man. There's so much, like back in the day when we were kids, we didn't know the stuff, you know what I mean? I didn't know who Easy Action was, you know what I mean? So, I'm a kid getting into glam metal in 1986, so I think I Want Action is a great song. And then, you know, you go listen to We Go Rocking by Easy Action with my boy Key Marcello and Zinny Zan, and it is the same exact chorus. So, what do you think?
Oh my God, it couldn't be any more exact. Like, it was thievery. And I had no idea about this whole debacle until a few years ago, and I went, I better check this out, because I heard of Easy Action, and they had, Key Marcello and members of Shotgun Messiah and whatnot, and I clicked it on the video, and I went, oh my God, that's about as blatant as same thing happened with Huey Lewis with I Want a New Drug and the Ghostbusters song.
Ghostbusters.
I mean, it's the exact same freaking thing. This one is like, holy shit. Like, they just heard the song and said, mine.
Then once again, we talked about when preparing for this episode, when you start searching for that stuff, you start going deeper. Like, there's other things that pop up in search engines. And there is an early 80s band called Kid Rocker. Not Kid Rock, Kid Rocker. Now, check out Kid Rocker. So, basically, I think CC was either associated with them or tried out for the band in the early 80s, something like that. But they play, man, that same style that's on Look What the Cat Dragged In, very similar to the Pretty Boy Floyd style. And they have a couple cool songs on YouTube that you can check out. And supposedly, I have found no proof of this, but this is once again, total rumor, is that CC lifted Talk Dirty to Me from these guys, that riff. So Is it true? I don't know. But if you listen to Kid Rocker, from what you can find on YouTube, you could say, yeah, it's very similar style, you know, so interesting. Who knows?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Crazy. Yeah, that one is blatant. That and it's stood up in court where they actually lost.
They lost, yeah.
So this one was pretty bad.
Now, this one is might be our only story of this, or maybe there's more, but this will be the first time we'll talk about like a love triangle, the romantic side of the drama.
Ooh.
And this is with Ricky Rocket and Richie Kotzen. You know, I mean, you know, I remember kind of like hearing there was something there. Like, that's how he got kicked out of the band. But I really didn't know much about it beyond that. So I kind of looked into it a little bit. So it sounds like earlier, maybe in 93, Ricky Rocket's fiance left him. And then months later, they find out that now she's going out with Kotzen. Now, did she leave him for Kotzen? I don't know. I don't really even care, to be honest with you. But this is where, this is a move of betrayal, and they kick Kotzen out of the band. So, I mean, like I said, look it up. I might not be saying it exactly right, but that's basically what it is.
Oh, yeah. And again, to refer to the old Behind the Music back in the old days, Brett talks all about this and says they found out what was going on. And he claims they pulled the tour bus over, kicked his ass, and threw him off the bus.
I remember that. Yeah, that I do remember that. So that's what he said.
A little bit of drama added to that one, a little flair added to that one. But, hey, homeboy deserved it.
Yeah.
So, adios, even though he's a good musician and a great singer, all that. But, you know, you can't breach that line. So.
Yeah, that's kind of messed up. Dude, I know you're huge into Death Leopard. What do you got? You guys must have something for Death Leopard. I know there's some conspiracies around these guys.
Oh, dude. Well, real quick, can I just throw out, before we go into Death Leopard, even though I have a good one for them, another love triangle?
Yeah.
Slash some rumor?
Yeah, let's hear it.
When you opened the door to that one, I thought, oh, okay. Do you remember back when Vince came out with Exposed? He came out with the video, Can't Have Your Cake?
Yeah.
And who was the star? Pamela Anderson.
Right.
And who? What was Vince up to back then? Humping everyone.
Right.
And he claims that he humped Pamela before Tommy, and Tommy freaking hated that rumor and tried to squash that one as best he could, because they were not the best of friends at that time when Tommy got with her. But Vince still claims that he got Pamela before Tommy, and that really pisses him off. So, you know, me being a big Vince supporter, I support that rumor.
The crazy thing is, though, you know, when I read The Dirt and I realized that, like, it was like Tommy and Vince knew each other pretty much before any of the guys did. And they were, you know, they were chummy in high school. And then to think, like, how they pretty much got right into fisticuffs around, 1999, and they really hated each other. Kind of weird. Yeah. You know, and I know a lot can happen over the years to make people change, but I always thought that was kind of weird. Yeah. I always knew they didn't like each other, and that was a big thing that, once again, honestly, I didn't even think about talking about this, but supposedly Vince sucker punched him or something in the face around this time, and you know, this was the time when he was leaving the band or something. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. I remember reading about that, too. Absolutely.
All right. Yeah. Dude, you opened up the can of worms. You had to say Motley Crue. And I'm going to just put the one out there right now first that everybody, maybe people don't remember this, or if you're younger, you don't remember this, man, but we got to talk about the Nikki Sixx imposter, Matthew Tripp. Okay, so.
Oh, yeah, what a weird one that was.
I remember this plain as day. I remember reading the magazine. It was Kerrang! Magazine. I remember being in a mall or something and reading this thing. And, you know, honestly, I'll be honest, I have gone way down the wormhole with this over the past couple of days trying to figure out what the real story was, because it's hard to find the actual Kerrang! Article. You can just find people talking about it and stuff. So basically, I'm going to just give you the high-level gist of it, is that Nikki Sixx was in a tragic car accident that put him either paralyzed or in a coma, and they needed a fill-in. So they get this guy, Matthew Tripp, and supposedly, I hear different stories, he was either in the band from 83 to 84, so some stories I hear that he was in the band then, And then other stories said he was in the band from like 83 to 85. So whatever the story, he was in the band for supposedly for a certain amount of time. And he wrote some of their songs, right? So, he's got a whole laundry list of things that supposedly, you know, he wrote. And I guess the guy was kind of into some demonic stuff, and he says that it was originally called Shout With The Devil. I remember reading that way back in the day in Kerrang. Funny thing is, when you read The Dirt, Nikki Sixx says the same thing, that it was a new issue. The song was originally called Shout With The Devil. And then when he got when he got freaked out about all that stuff, they changed it. So that's weird how the Trip thing and Nikki Sixx's viewpoints kind of went together. So basically, you know, they're just he's just trying to say that, you know, that's what he did, and then he got kicked out of the band when Nikki Sixx was okay. But people have really dug deep into this one, you know, and there's a lot of things out there, and I sent you one, and I'll put this out on Twitter once we get this interview out there. Nikki does have some different looks when you go through the years. You know, if you look at him in 81, he has a very kind of like chiseled chin, very, cubic almost, you know, chiseled like a Batman chin or something like that. You look at his chin around Theater of Pain, it's very round. Now, does that mean he just put on some weight on his face? He was obviously doing a lot of drugs and drinking and stuff, so could that be part of it? And then you look at him again around Feel Good, and he's got that same chin again. You know, so you know, you can look at – there's a lot of inconsistencies. And they even say with – back to this Matthew Tripp thing, they say there's a lot of inconsistencies with height. So Nikki – for the most part, always is towered over Vince. But then when you look at him in Theater of Pain, they almost seem very close in height. That could be one guy's wearing heels, one guy's not. Another thing is they said that Matthew Tripp was basically broke. You know, he was just like a nut job, you know, loser. I hate to say that, but that's basically what it is. But he had the most expensive tattoos that were the exact replicas of Nikki Sixx, you know. And even people that were close to him say they don't necessarily believe what he was saying, but the dude had a lot of stuff in his arsenal. He had a speeding ticket that was made out to his name. But the car was registered to Mick Mars. That's just what – these are just weird claims. Somebody else claimed that different thing. He had a lot of pictures of being backstage with the band and all kinds of stuff. So, once again, the dude's probably a nut bar just trying to get some attention. But it sounds like there's some weird stuff out there, man, about Motley Crue with this whole story. So, what do you think about it?
Yeah, were those pictures of him being backstage with the band, were those ever released? Or were they released – in the 80s, or were they released now and they could have been photoshopped, because it definitely wasn't happening then?
No, I don't think they've ever been released. Yeah.
But then the other connection was the Mick Mars connection, where he said that Mick was the one that contacted him in like 82.
Yes.
Because that's when Nicky was supposed to have gotten in this accident.
Yep.
But I don't think at that point anybody had the foresight. You know what I mean? Like, they were just coming out with Too Fast for Love on Elektra, and I don't think anybody was foreseen Motley being what Motley turned into in 82.
No.
Other than, you know, a few insiders, but not to the extent that they could success they achieved. So that is the part of the story that kind of aced me out at the start of it, because I was thinking, no, if Mick recruited him in 82, there's no way that anybody would have thought that this needed to happen. They would have just disbanded.
Yeah.
Now, if this happened in 85 and it was like a Vince situation where Vince was in jail for years, you know, that would have been the end of the crew, or they would have done the a Vince version of the story. You know what I mean? Like, that I could maybe see. But at this point in time, it didn't happen for 4 or 5 years, you know. But I do get what you're saying in terms of Nikki's look, because he went from his puppy dog faced in 81 to that, but he had the square jaw to that real chiseled look in 89, 90. But, you know, like we talked about, I always attributed that to just getting off the dope and shedding the baby fat and running every day and doing sit-ups and everything they were doing. So, yeah, Nikki looked great at that point, but I attributed that to just a healthier lifestyle. So I think this guy is probably full of shit.
Yeah. You know, and like I said, once again, if this is something that you remember checking out in, 88 when it came out in Kerrang, and you want to revisit the story, there's all kinds of crazy talking stuff, and there's all, dude, there's so many articles that I found of people supposedly that worked for Doc McGee's office, you know, coming out with the, oh yeah, we saw his name on contracts and stuff. You know, I said, maybe this guy, it could be one of those things, man, you know, where there's just one little thing, like he did this one little thing with Motley Crue, and then he blew it up into something crazy, or he never did anything, yeah. And it was just trying to get some notoriety. But once again, it's an interesting tale. It makes for good conspiracy crew conspiracy. You know, that should be, maybe they can do a book, you know, but it makes for good fun.
That's it. Exactly.
All right. So once again, we don't have, there's so much with Crue, but what about this one? Now, as I research ghost players and all this stuff, this also seems to be pretty well known. I didn't know it, that DJ Ashba played all the rhythms on Saints of Los Angeles. Had you ever heard that one before?
I have heard that, and I don't know why that would have been. I mean, if Nick had gone stadium tour in 2022, why couldn't he have played studio guitar to Saints of Los Angeles? Mm-hmm. And what was that, 08 or something like that?
Yeah.
You know, I wonder, but maybe he was really kind of just getting back in the swing of things. They did kind of dig him up out of the trenches of his deep dark home to get him back in the band when they kind of reunited. So maybe, you know, maybe he was at that low point and he wasn't on his meds and he was broke and divorced and all this and that. But I mean, Ashba was a hot young guitar player playing in Mickey's other band, so maybe Mickey was like into his style more at that point.
How about this whole Sebastian Bach being offered the role in Motley Crue? So, you know, we know, yeah. I know that Stephen Chereau tried out. He confirmed
that in an interview.
Mark Torian, I think that's the way you're supposed to say it, but I've always said Torian. He says that he did. So that's been out there, or at least there was talks. Whether he tried out, he was definitely being considered. But the one that Motley Crue denies to this day is that Sebastian Bach was offered the role. And Sebastian says, and I've never read his book, so I don't know, you haven't probably either, because you're not the biggest fan. But he says he can, and once again, maybe he does this in his book. I should read the book so I know what the hell I'm talking about. But he says he can detail this right down. You know, he knows, he remembers the sandwich that Tommy Lee was eating when he got offered the job. He knows every detail. This does not seem far fetched to me, though. What do you think?
This one, I don't know, David. Skid Row is at their peak at this point. Like, I don't see it happening, dude.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why anybody would lie about this. I mean, they're both humongous at that point. I don't know, man. This is one of those where it's hard for me to believe, but at the same time, why would both camps lie about it?
Right.
Just, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this one I've always just been pretty much just confused by. I don't know what the hell had been going on there, but Sebastian was getting a little bit unhappy, as you could tell with what unfolded like 3 years later.
Yep.
But I mean, like 92, dude, like Skid Row had a number one album at that point. Like there was, I don't see it. I don't see him leaving other than the fact that he was an incredible fanboy because he was in his teens in the heyday. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, he was in his teens during the time Motley was humongous, and maybe it was his dream to be in that band. You know what I mean? So who knows? Maybe he felt that he had the success he could achieve in Skid Row, and he wanted to move on to his heroes and be in that band. But,
yeah.
Dude, I don't know. This is a tough one for me to believe from both camps.
Well, I look at it this way.
On that one.
I look at it this way. I don't think, and I think the decision, I'm assuming what he's saying is that, you know, everybody was telling him he has a better shot in Skid Row because they were so big at the time. But I think for Motley Crue, that would have been a no-brainer on a commercial. And I've said this before on my Twitter site and in different videos. I think commercially, this would have been a slam dunk for Motley Crue. You know, it'd be almost like the Sammy Hagar thing with Van Halen. You're bringing in a known guy. You're bringing in a guy that's huge right now. You know what I mean? With a huge fan base. That would have been a commercial slam dunk. The Karabi thing, I know you're not a big fan of that album. I do like it. But once again, he wasn't a household name And maybe that was part of it, why it didn't work. You know, Vince was a huge personality and a big piece of the band. So I don't know, man. I think Crew had more to gain than at that point than Sebastian. But if Sebastian had the crystal ball and he knew what was coming, maybe he would have made the move. But once again, he was kind of riding high on the success. He had no idea that it was all going to get pulled out from under him.
That's right. Exactly.
Last one about Crew, man. So this is another one. I remember reading this. I can't find a thing on it now, and I know why, because Blackie Lawless is about to put out a book. But he was putting all kinds of journals out there on the Wasp Nation website, and he said that when he was in the band Sister, they had all kinds of pentagrams and all kinds of evil stage imagery, and they wanted to kind of get away from that and kind of do more of a shock rock thing is what they ended up doing with Wasp, and he sold all that shit to Nikki Sixx. And Blackie says that, you know, that whatever was going on, it's just bad stuff, and he didn't want any part of that stuff anymore. And he feels that with Motley Crue kind of putting that out there the way they did, that that opened up some kind of darkness and that has always plagued that band for their whole career. Interesting point of view. That's all I'm going to say. Interesting point of view.
That is weird. I remember Nicky, part of the Dirt, him talking about the pentagram stuff going on and silverware sticking to the ceiling.
Yes, very freaky. Very freaky.
Yes, scary stuff like that. Maybe I either forgot about or missed the part where he picked it all up from Blackie, but you don't mess around with that kind of stuff, man.
No way, man. No way. All right.
That's the real deal.
Let's get into Leopard. I got one little tiny thing but you're the man. What's so controversial about Death Leopard? What do they got?
Oh, dude, to me, Def Leppard is like such a class act band. They're like AC/DC, man. They're like, they're private, but, you know, they're good guys. But one thing, and this is completely opinion, this is going to either piss people off or spread a rumor, but I'm not trying to do either. This has just strictly been my opinion for years, and that is, so they had Pete Willis on guitar from their inception through the recording of Pyromania, and I believe Phil Collin came in and recorded the solo in Photograph and some other guitar parts. But it was in the recording sessions for the massive Pyromania that they decided to part ways with Pete Willis. And it pissed a lot of old-time fans off because he was responsible, along with Steve Clark, for the riffs on the first album, On Through the Night, and then High and Dry, which is regarded as, you know, one of the classic hard rock Def Leppard albums before they became a little bit more polished. So in '82, during the recording sessions, they decided that they would dump Pete and bring Phil Collin in, who they'd known from the band Girl for years. And let's face it, Phil was a much better looking guy. He got along with the band very, very well, and he played great. And I think, and this is, like, again, I'm just saying my opinion, I think they kicked Pete out because he didn't have a look.
Huh.
I think they had a feeling that Def Leppard was about to pop and be enormous. You know, they had success with High and Dry, and they probably saw the writing on the wall with Pyromania and thought, okay, Mutt's throwing out that they're going to have a Michael Jackson hard rock album with six or seven singles, and they're going to be humongous. You know, and they started off playing theaters on that tour and ended up at Joe Robbie Stadium in San Diego, headlining with Crocus and I think Motley actually opening. And, you know, they were obviously huge.
Uh-huh.
And I really do think that they took a look at Pete and thought, nope, we're going to gain that much more success with a good looking dude that can play the shit out of guitar like Phil.
Huh.
And they brought him in for that reason. Now, here's the thing. No one ever has to say the truth in Def Leppard.
Correct.
Because they could stick to their story of, yeah, he drank too much. He was falling down drunk coming into the studio, which is probably true, but I'm sure the element of him not having the look probably assisted in that, and they said, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
This is our opportunity. So, I don't know, man. There's probably some people out there that agree, and there's probably some people out there that call me a big asshole for thinking that and saying that. But, I mean, hey, no one's ever got to say the truth, but might be there. That's my, like, one big conspiracy when it comes to this.
Maybe. And it's funny, as soon as you started talking about this Pete Willis and everything, I remember I watched that cheesy movie that was on VH1. Remember they was like, and actually it wasn't really bad, but I do remember that, like, that was the story in there, that he was just an alcoholic and it was basically, you know, affecting the band, and that's why he got put out. So, but, you know, hey, like I said, that might have gave that extra push, like, hey, this dude's a lot cooler, he's got a better look, he's not drunk 24/7, let's get this guy out of here. Who the hell knows, man? You don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
The only thing that I was finding on Def Leppard was how they had basically an issue with Universal Records. And I don't think they're alone with doing this or having issues. But basically, I was reading how they were kind of pissed off because they didn't think we're getting the right cut from Universal. So they basically bootlegged or re-recorded their own songs, basically, right? And just so they could get a little piece of the pie, because they weren't getting anything from, like, the digital platforms. And that's why, like, they re-recorded a lot of their hits, so they could basically cash in and get some cash. You ever heard that one before?
I haven't, but they were holdouts for a long time on Spotify. Mm-hmm. They were one of the last huge bands to be on there, and it was only a couple years ago that they decided to put their entire catalog on there. And, I mean, it made me happy, but I know it doesn't make any artist too much money. Mm-hmm. But I had never heard that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look that one up, and if you notice, a lot of bands have done the same thing. Kiss had done that, re-recorded a lot of their classic songs, and then when you notice, Twisted Sister did it as well. They redid "We're Not Going to Take It," and the big thing was having songs in Guitar Hero. And I always noticed that, like, when my kids played Guitar Hero, nine times out of ten, it was a re-recorded version of the song. Alice Cooper redid "I'm 18." Twisted Sister redid "We're Not Going to Take It." And to the average kid who doesn't really know this music, they would never know. But I could tell that these were re-recorded, and they were good, but they weren't like the originals. You know, so money thing, man. It comes down to money.
I remember Dee talking about that in some interviews. I think it was with Eddie Trunk, actually, about how he, no matter what, was going to keep the rights to his songs, even through the low times in the 90s when he was back doing a 9-to-5 job and they were having a hard time making ends meet. He even said at that point that he could have sold the rights to his songs and financially gained, but man, it's really done him well ever since, because his songs are in every commercial and every movie.
Big time.
So that's a damn good idea, damn good choice he made.
So here's a real dark one, man, and I got to go back to an interview I did with Greg Chason of Badlands, and, you know, basically just, I asked him straight out, man, because I like Badlands. I'm like, why is Badlands not on Spotify? What's going on? Why can't I ever find any Badlands on there? He's like, man, I don't know. You know, we went against the grain. We pissed off Atlantic Records, and they're just holding it against us up to this day. So I'm like, okay, cool, man. Sure, sounds good. So then I put the interview out. That story hits headlines, and then all of a sudden, everybody's in the comments saying, "No, man. When Ray Gillen had AIDS, he deliberately infected others, and all these families have lawsuits against his estate and Atlantic Records." And I'm just like, what the hell? I mean, I didn't know that. You know what I mean? And then once you go down that wormhole, go to any message board. This was just on the message boards on Metal Sludge. It's out there, man. This story won't go away. What do you think?
Dude. I had never heard that until you kind of brought it up in the last couple of weeks, and I did a little bit of research, but man, if that's true, I don't blame these record companies for holding these guys. I mean, if that's true, I hope it's not, obviously, but I've never heard something like that before. That's about as low as it gets, and not knowing the guy, I certainly didn't see that coming, especially from the people that still speak pretty highly about him, that are his peers and other musicians. So I hope that story is true and that there's some kind of business misfortune that went on and not something personal like that, obviously.
Right, right, yeah. You know, and like, you can always get trolls that are going to throw that out there in the comments, you know, but like, once again, where's the proof? I guess when they put it out on Rock Candy Records, you know, they re-release a lot of albums. It got halted up for this reason, supposedly. But to me, even after all these years, let's just say that is true. I don't, you know, once again, who knows? I have no idea. What benefit is there to not have the music out there? Because A, there are other musicians and writers involved. And B, why can't that money be put toward a charity or something? Like, to me, like, what good is this music doing just doing nothing? Michael Jackson's music still out there. All these, once again, there's a lot of allegations against him, but his music's still out there. So I don't know, man.
Yeah.
It's kind of a head scratcher.
Yeah, that is a very bad one. that's a pretty crappy rumor to have about you.
Yeah.
It's just a rumor.
All right, so this is my last one I got. And once again, a lot of these things come to light during this internet age that we're in. When I was a kid, I had no idea. So I was looking at these pictures. I was looking up Striper. I don't know, maybe I was trying to get pictures for a thumbnail or something I did. And I see this dude in the band. Back in 86, you know, like back then they had like the set costumes, like Tim Gaines was the race car driver and Oz Fox was the timekeeper. And I don't even know what the other guys were, but whatever. They were wearing yellow and black. It was all working. But there's this dude and it ain't Tim Gaines, right? So I'm like, what the hell is this? And for a short period, he was replaced by Matt Hurick. Okay. Don't know. The dude got replaced. And I guess another guy was a session player that played on the album. I guess in Michael Sweet's book, Tim Gaines just didn't have the right vibe for this album. And then just by some strange coincidence, this other dude's out. Tim Gaines is back in, and he's on all the album art, you know. But once again, I wasn't reading inside of album liner notes to this level. You know, maybe it says additional bass. That's the that's the secret code word, right? Additional drums, Cozy Powell. You didn't know he played the whole damn album, you know what I mean? So like, somewhere on that album, it probably says additional bass. But, yeah, Tim Gaines did not play on To Hell With the Devil, but he did all the videos. He did the tour. That one kind of blew my mind.
God, I never knew that. And it seems like a mid-career shift like that is a pretty big deal, especially at that point when they're just kind of taking off and getting huge. I never knew that. I'll have to go back and look because I have that collection, all those old magazines.
Yeah.
Maybe they snuck one in there and maybe it's by accident or not.
And then I'm not going to get too much into this story because I don't, who knows what's true or not. But, you know, back to Tim Gaines, there's a lot of controversy that surrounds him in and out of this band. He's kind of been in and out a few different times. I think he was, when they regrouped, he wasn't there in the early 2000s. And then he just was out, whether they let him go, he quit, whatever. And now the guy from Firehouse, Perry Richardson's in there. But, you know, he claims that, you know, the guys in Striper didn't like that he was getting a divorce, didn't like his new wife. They're saying it had nothing to do with that. They just were set with him. And he went on a real tirade. Once again, I think I did listen to a podcast more recently with him, and he says he regrets a lot of the things he said. Don't know if it's true or not, but he basically came out and said that Michael Sweet lives kind of like the high life, makes crap loads of money off of Striper, and the other guys don't make shit. They're just kind of like session dudes, and they just kind of have beat up cars. And once again, I don't know if that's true, man, but this is the kind of stuff that it happens, you know, in bands. So.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I do follow Michael Sweet on social media, and it looks like he lives a good life.
Uh-huh.
And the other guys kind of just everyday Joes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I could see that happening. Well, there's one I want to put to bed, though. There's one big one that I want to put to bed, and that is the Bon Scott writing lyrics for Back in Black.
Okay, what do you got?
I've never bought that rumor because being, you know, like, you're not going to touch on Kiss, and this is as much as I'm going to touch on my boys in AC/DC, but as big of a fan as I am and knowing both singers' songwriting styles and what their lyrics say and mean, I never picked up on that because Back in Black was different in every aspect than any Bon Scott AC/DC album. So I never picked up on that. There was the rumor that Bon had said he'd come up with lyrics to You Shook Me All Night Long, and it was the girlfriend of Bon Scott at the time that claimed that one of the things that he says in the song is she had the sightless eyes is something that Bon would have said, and she witnessed him writing it down. Huh. Now, that song, I don't think so. I think this is all Brian Johnson, lyrics, and the only one is the title of Rock and Roll Ain't Noise Pollution, which Bon came up with, and the boys kept, and they used that as a song title, and that's it. And then Brian Johnson just put out his memoir, and it's a really cool book. I picked it up already. And in the book, Brian says, I want to put this to bed. I want to squash it. I respect the shit out of Bon Scott. I love him. He did not write a single lyric for Back in Black. Uh-huh. It was all me. I had like 5 weeks to do it, and I knocked it all out.
Nice.
So I want to put that one to bed. And I do believe Brian Johnson, and just being a fan, I think that the lyrics are completely different than anything Bon Scott would have come up with. So that was a big AC/DC one. Now, we'll save our AC/DC and Kiss conspiracy episode for another time. Later part date. Two.
One last one that came to mind, and I should have mentioned this when Blackie Lawless came out. This one's kind of come up to light just in recent times. So obviously a lot of guys in and out of a Wasp, you know, obviously Steve Riley, Johnny Rodd, you know, you name it, a lot of guys in and out of Wasp. But one shitty thing that Chris Holmes claims is, and this kind of goes back to what I was thinking with Stryper, you know, that sometimes this happens because somebody kind of takes control of the band and writes a lot of the songs. And when you write the songs, that kind of is the cash cow. But Chris says, you know, and I think if you look at some of the earlier albums, he has a few songwriting credits here or there. But when you look at the way the contract's set up, this is what Chris Holmes is stating. Blackie's saying no. That Chris Holmes is listed as a session player. He is not listed as a band member. He's not listed as a writer. And he says that because of the way he thought Blackie was looking out for him, and Blackie put him in as a session player on the Wasp albums, he doesn't get shit off of any kind of writing that he did or anything that he came up with. So, once again, is that just some – with all these stories, man, when that people come out, are they just bitter because, you know, they got kicked out of the band or there's hard feelings, or – or is there some screw jobs that take place? Once again, that's controversies of hair metal.
Because, because it makes sense. Because I've always seen pictures and read about Blackie living the high life, and I'm going, dude, Wasp was big, but they weren't that big. It's like, how is this guy affording the shit he affords and living the life he lives and kind of recognized and touted as this like giant rock star when, that Wasp was pretty freaking big, but they were never, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but were they headliners? Like, maybe for a couple
theaters.
Of years, tops?
Yeah, small places, never any place huge, no.
Yeah, and, like, they didn't sell millions.
Nope.
So I can see if that were the case, contract-wise, what little or to, you know, semi-pretty decent success they had, he would cash in on all of it. And that may be why he's living the life he lived and regarded as one of the more wealthy, famous-ish rock stars out there. But, man, that makes sense now that you're saying that, because I have read and seen interviews with Chris Holmes, and he ain't nothing tearing it up either. So, I see that one being true.
Man, this was good, you know, and I just can't wait to put this one out there, and I can't wait to all the people to jump in and say, oh, you forgot about this one, you got to hear about this one. And in reality, I want to hear what people have to say. I hope they pull out a few that we missed. And like I said, you know, we're an hour in, and this is pretty much the cutoff, but, you know, you could go for, you know, like I said, if you threw Kiss in the mix or some of these other bands, you could go for hours. All right, man, have a good one. Thanks as always.
Yeah, of course, anytime.
Talk to you, buddy. Bye.
Forget everything you heard in this episode. Try to go on and live a normal life. Rock on!